Tonight we walk into what is really a very significant court case. The outcome of this case, if I understand it correctly, we will hear Ian speak about this, could determine how religious bodies seeking to serve the needs of our world will be able to do that. How will they be able to do that? And if the judgment eventually falls on one side, we may have a situation that when Ian first told me about it, I was reminded of a moment in the history of the early church. I can't recall exactly whether it was the Emperor Diocletian or one of his predecessors who was told by one of his Secretary of State, his Henry Kissinger, was told by him that the Christian community, or this fledgling community of the people of the way, were feeding the hungry of Rome. And the emperor inquired as to whose hungry they were feeding. Were they feeding their own hungry? That is, the Christian hungry? Or were they feeding his poor? And when he heard that they were feeding his poor, he went into a rage and initiated one of the more devastating pogroms on the fledgling Christian community in that moment. It is always a struggle for the church, it seems to me, to care for its own and care for the world. And sometimes, of course, the church turns inward. But often the church has understood its work as being that of the life of the world, the way in which our Lord taught us to care about it. This case is a moment, it seems to me, in Canadian history where that question is at work, so it is worth paying attention to. Ian Benson, I've known Ian for some years, got to know him initially through reading him on the Center for Cultural Renewal website, and particularly the extraordinary body of legal cases called Lexview, which he continued to write over some 70 cases, which he has analyzed. A number of those cases, he's actually represented people before regional, provincial, and the Supreme Court of Canada. There is nobody else in the country that has anything like Ian's track record on engaging these issues. When I first met Ian and we sat down, and I realized he was rather partial to single malt scotch, which is one of the few things that, you know, this is an old King's connection. You know, single malt scotch may in fact justify Calvinism, even to some of us who were born Lutheran. So I realized very quickly that Ian not only had a cunning legal mind, but had a wonderful philosophical mind. And I was delighted to see that, and am delighted to call him friend and colleague. He has become a senior associate counsel of the national law firm Miller Thompson LLP, and is pursuing work internationally with them as well, largely associated with cases of which there are many already, and there will be far more in the future. Cases that have to do with religion and public life. He studied in Canada, Scotland, England, holds degrees from Queen's University, the University of Cambridge in law, and the University of Windsor in law. He is also, at the moment, a doctoral student. I have no idea why. I think he should forget that. I hate to say that publicly to you, but you don't need it, Ian. But he's working on this in constitutional law at the University in Johannesburg. Also, they have made him or as of at the University of the Free State. He's become extraordinary professor in the Department of Constitutional Law. He was called to the bar in 1985 and has appeared, as I mentioned, at virtually all levels of court. He's also been engaged, I think it's remarkable, in a project in South Africa for the development of a charter of religious rights. First part of the world where we see this happening. That has a good deal to do with what Steve Martin has devoted himself to in part, the whole Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, it created a culture where there was a concern for these things. Ian has published widely in a number of law journals as well, and he is has represented the has made representations to a number of federal commissions associated with these issues of law and faith and the state. We could have no one better to open this, not only to open the case for us, but to look at the profound questions that exist here and the way in which in our country, as we seek, I hope, to become deeply pluralistic, to make space for a variety of religious traditions out of what is best in them. So, Ian, I'm delighted you're here. Thanks for coming, and we look forward to your talk.
Thank you, David. I'd like to thank the Ronning Center and its director, David Gore, for the invitation to present this Ronning Forum this evening. I'd also like to thank the King's University College for opening its facility here, and to its president, who is here this evening. What I'd like to do in this paper is two things. First, to give an overview of the decision in Heinz and Christian Horizons, and second, to discuss the case in context, particularly the emerging understanding of the nature of the public sphere generally and the nature of associational rights in particular. I've often spoken in recent years and written on the nature of the secular, because that's a term that's often confused and misused. And I won't be discussing that this evening, but at the outset I'd like simply to point out that religious believers have no less place in the public sphere of a free and democratic society than do other believers. And here atheists and agnostics have to be understood as believers. I don't know how we got in the situation we're in, but we seem to have bifurcated our language just in almost every aspect of how we describe the public sphere when we refer to it as secular. Because for most people, secular means non-religious. Therefore, if the public sphere is described as secular, and secular means public education, legal ethics, or law, medical ethics, and so forth, then those are necessarily non-religious. But of course, this doesn't work when you think about the nature of citizenship and belief, and the fact that everybody who has a right to be involved in the public sphere brings their beliefs with them to the public sphere. Therefore, if secular means non-religious, but it's the public realm, then the only believers that are bracketed out of full involvement are the religious ones. Atheism and agnosticism are, on that reading, given private position. Well, that sort of quick deconstruction of the standard language of our time is something we all need to do. And one of the things I've suggested to organizations is that they cease using the term secular because of that deep ambiguity and the bifurcative nature in which it drives religion and religious projects and religious believers into second-class citizenship. Now, that's relevant in this Christian Horizons case. I've given a handout here. Everyone should have it. The relevant provisions for the purposes of my comments start on really this second page, if you turn it over. Everyone should have that in front of them. The first page is provisions from the Canadian Constitution Act 1982, which we know more colloquially as the part we're talking about, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And there's the Section 1 test and so forth, and equality and fundamental freedoms. The Heinz and Christian Horizons wasn't a charter case. It was a case argued under the Ontario Human Rights Code. And interestingly, there's a provision in our constitutional law that where there's a statutory ambiguity, the court will use what it calls charter values as an interpretive guide to the meaning of the statute. So, in a sense, the first page, which contains the charter enumerated provisions, doesn't come into play, but charter values do. Sort of strange to imagine what the court means by charter values, because of course they're not enumerated anywhere. And what it's an approach that gives the court the maximal ability to use whatever it thinks is relevant in the analysis, but it doesn't help the rest of us determine what's relevant when we go into these charter values type cases. And that's what the Heinz and Christian Horizons case is going to involve us in, a charter values type analysis. I think it might be useful for you to hear how I'm involved in the case before I even get into describing what it is. I've been retained to act for a group called the Ontario Conference of Catholic Bishops, along with the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada that represents some 30 Protestant denominations. The Canadian Council of Christian Charities has also applied for intervention status. So there's the bishops, the EFC, Canadian Council of Christian Charities, all intervening at the first level of judicial review. This is quite unusual. Normally these groups would only appear really at the Court of Appeal level, the highest provincial level, and then the Supreme Court of Canada. But the significance of the decision is such that they all wanted to get in early. And in my case, on behalf of the bishops of the Catholic religion, I made an application last December to actually do something unusual, which was to supplement the record of what was before the human right, had been before the Human Rights Tribunal. Typically on judicial review, that's very unusual to supplement the record, but in this case, I thought it was very important, and I made the argument before the judge in December that we wanted to do that, and I was given the right to do that. And what I've put into the court, and that'll be considered in December when we argue it, are two affidavits, one from the head of Catholic Charities for Toronto, 29 charitable agencies, and another one, much longer, from the former chair of the Department of Sociology at Queen's University, David Lyon, an extremely eminent Canadian sociologist, spelling out the significance of religion to society. So I want to argue that part of the charter values that we want to bring to bear here is a recognition of the role that religion plays to culture, and in particular the role that Christian charitable endeavor plays to the common good of Canadian society. So that will be in the affidavit of David Lyon, and I'll be making argument before the court about that in December. Now, on the other side of the intervention slate is EGAL, which is Equality for Gays and Lesbians Everywhere, very sophisticated and capable Canadian group representing the interests of gays and lesbians. They always have top-notch counsel and do an excellent job for their side of the arguments. So this is a case that's going to have, you know, a pretty high-level debate happening right at the first level of court, and we can imagine that will continue. And I expect, given the importance of the case, that there'll be even more participants by the time it gets to the Court of Appeal and even more by the time it gets to the Supreme Court of Canada. So what's the case about? Well, if you turn to the second page and look at the bottom where it says, under the heading Freedom from Discrimination, and for those who are listening to this in the disconnected world of CDs, or however this is recorded eventually, what I'm referring everyone to is the Ontario Human Rights Code provision, Section 5, under the heading Employment. And it says basically, every person has a right to equal treatment with respect to employment without discrimination because of race, ancestry, place of origin, color, ethnic origin, citizenship, creed, sex, sexual orientation, age, record of offenses, marital status, family status, or disability. So that's the general equal treatment provision in relation to employment. If you go to the next page, under section 24.1, that right under section 5 to equal treatment with respect to employment is not infringed where A, a religious, philanthropic, educational, fraternal, or social institution or organization that is primarily engaged in serving the interests of persons identified by their race, ancestry, place of origin, color, ethnic origin, creed, sex, age, marital status, or disability, employs only or gives preference in employment to persons similarly identified if the qualification is a reasonable and bona fide qualification because of the nature of employment. That's the key set of principles. One, you shouldn't be discrimination in employment. Two, there is a non-infringement for what are called special employment categories, and that includes, right up front, a religious organization primarily engaged. That's the key. Those are the key languages. So that's the statutory framework. So what happened in Heinz? Well, Christian Horizons is a project that goes back some 40 years. It's involved in putting people with developmental handicaps into long-term care in a domestic care environment, homes for the developmentally handicapped. It's the largest recipient of government funding in this area in Ontario, receiving many, many millions of dollars per year of government funding. It has some 2,500 employees and 180 care homes in Ontario, and cares for approximately 1,400 individuals with developmental disabilities. It is a religious organization. From its inception as an evangelical Protestant project, it has made it very clear that what it does is an outreach of its religious mission. Its board, its guiding minds are all Christians, and its employees have to sign a conduct clause, not dissimilar from the one that the students at Trinity Western University had to sign in the famous case that went to the Supreme Court of Canada some years ago and held that conduct clauses of that sort were legitimate. So enter the scene an employee called Connie Heinz. Now, according to the information published in the decision, Connie Heinz was born into a devout Mennonite family and identified with and fully participated in the religion of her upbringing while she was growing up. She committed her life to God in her mid-20s and eventually graduated from the Emmanuel Bible College in Kitchener in 1995, having majored in Christian ministry and Christian counseling. She started working for Christian Horizons in Waterloo as a part-time support worker in a community living residence for individuals with developmental disabilities. After graduation, she obtained a full-time position with Christian Horizons in May of 1995. She chose to work at Christian Horizons because, in her words, she was called by God to do Christian ministry. So, as I said, all employees of Christian Horizons were expected to adopt and sign the religious doctrinal statement of the organization, as well as lifestyle and morality standards, which were based on the religious views of the organization. Now, as with the Trinity Western case, the standards listed various prohibited conduct as being incompatible, in this case, with effective Christian counseling ideals. Prohibited were extramarital sexual relationships, adultery, premarital sexual relationships, fornication, reading or viewing pornographic material, homosexual relationships, theft, fraud, physical aggression, abusive behavior, sexual assault, harassment, lying and deceit, and the use of illegal drugs. When she was hired, Connie Heinz had no difficulty with this arrangement and signed the signed the contract and obtained employment. 4 years later, however, Ms. Heinz did have a serious problem with the morality code of her religious employer. She had come to the realization, she said, that she was a lesbian and had taken up a lesbian relationship with a person who was not working at Christian Horizons. Now, she, on the evidence, withheld this information from the employer for some 6 months before admitting the situation to her immediate supervisor after she was confronted by the supervisor as a result of rumors in the workplace that she was in a same-sex relationship. Once Christian Horizons had noticed that Heinz was not in compliance with the religious morality required of all employees, and more particularly that Heinz had no intention of complying in the future, Christian Horizons continued to employ her for a period of 5 months, had meetings with her, and suggested, amongst other things, that she obtain counseling or offered her counseling in her situation. She was invited to find another job or effect changes. Long and short of it was that she decided first to take medical leave from work and eventually resigned and went to the Ontario Human Rights Commission. That commission held a hearing, went for some 40 days. It involved 21 witnesses, and more than 7 years after Connie Heinz had originally lodged the complaint with the commission, the adjudicator, Michael Gottheil, delivered his decision. Connie Heinz's claim was upheld against Christian Horizons. The adjudicator first determined that Horizons did not fall under the special employer exemption in the Ontario Human Rights Code and thus was not justified in discriminating against any employee on the basis of religion or sexual orientation. I'll explain why in a minute. Secondly, even if Christian Horizons had fallen into the exemption, they would still have lost the case because the moral code was not a bona fide occupational qualification for support workers at Christian Horizons. Thirdly, even if Christian Horizons had fallen into the exemption, and even if the bona fide occupational requirement had been established, Christian Horizons was still liable to Connie Heinz in any event for creating or allowing a poisoned work environment to develop after Heinz revealed her sexual orientation. Now, the remedy was, in the words of law professor Alvin Esau from the University of Manitoba Law Faculty, costly and intrusive. Alvin Esau is one of the most learned legal minds in this area of accommodation, the duty of accommodation. And he shared a case comment with me that he prepared on this case, and I'm using that quite extensively in these opening comments. While Connie Heinz's case was advanced by the Ontario Human Rights Commission on her behalf, without financial risk to her, we assume that a hearing of 40 days, along with numerous pre-hearing processes, would probably have cost Christian Horizons hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees. Now, additionally, the organization was ordered to pay Heinz $8,000 for the humiliation, hurt feelings, and loss of dignity and self-respect imposed on her by the discriminatory policy of Christian Horizons. A further $10,000 was awarded in general damage for the poisoned work environment holding. An additional $5,000 was awarded for mental anguish because of what the tribunal ruled was willful and reckless action on the part of Christian Horizons. In addition, Christian Horizons was ordered to pay Heinz the wages and benefits she would have received for about 2 years after she left her employment with them. We don't know from the decision exactly what that amount would be, but with the other damages awarded and prejudgment interest, excluding the question of costs, she was probably awarded well over $100,000 for the discrimination against her. With several hundred thousand dollars in legal fees and an award of $100,000, we're now up to $300,000 to $500,000 in costs and award. Having declared that the religiously based code of conduct of Christian Horizons was discriminatory as to each and every employee, Gottheil gave the organization 6 months to develop an anti-discrimination and anti-harassment policy and a human rights training program for all employees and managers. In consultation with the Ontario Human Rights Commission, Christian Horizons was ordered to review its employment policies and submit a report to the Human Rights Tribunal as to how the organization was going to comply with the code. The religious organization now has no religious freedom to hire people on the basis of conformity to religious norms. The right of homosexuals not to be discriminated against in employment is apparently of greater value than the religious freedom to associate together in religious ministry with like-minded co-religionists. In particular, the decision held that the employer could not be considered a religious employer because it served people in Christian Horizons facilities, some of whom were not members of the religion. What this means is that if to qualify as a religious special exemption employer, you have to only serve your own religion, Christian missionary projects of all sorts, whether education, healthcare, or any of the kind of charitable agency work that my clients, the Catholic Charities, are involved in Toronto, in which the people served are not asked for their religious affiliation, which is to say all of them, means that those projects can no longer maintain their Christian identity or their Jewish identity or whatever religious identity they have. Religions under this interpretation are forced into their own footprints, and the tribunal here is telling religious associations that their purpose in the public sphere is to serve themselves, when in fact, from the very beginning, most of these projects have understood their purpose to be precisely to serve others than themselves. So, on one level, this is a gross interference with the freedom of religion at its heart, at its very core understanding of what its civic function is, what its mission is. Now, interestingly, some 11 years before this decision, in a case called Parks and Christian Horizons, involving the same employer, a different tribunal of the Human Rights Commission determined that Christian Horizons had breached the Human Rights Code, not because of how it served people who were members or non-members of the religion, but because of the manner in which it enforced the code of conduct inside the organization. And the tribunal determined, set out what the Christian Horizons had to do in order to comply with the code. And it was on the basis of that earlier decision in Parks that Christian Horizons formed its internal policies for many years. So what we have is not only an interpretation that's radically at variance with how many people would interpret the statute, but is it radically at variance with what the tribunal itself said to the same employer 11 years before? So in terms of administrative law coherence, there's an argument to be made that here what's happened is that a tribunal is effectively forcing an employer, ruling an employer in breach of the legislation, when what it had been doing was following the very directions of the same tribunal years before. Kind of double bind. Now I'd like to draw the lens back a bit and ask some questions about the wider context in which this case is occurring. And the first thing I want to do is draw on a theoretical insight of English philosopher John Gray and an American commentator, William Galston. And then I want to look at some comments of Chief Justice McLaughlin in the very, very important exchange that happened at McGill University some years ago between her and an American philosopher, Jean Bethke Elstein. And I want to suggest these three sets of insights are linked and are extremely important and relevant in Christian Horizons. And indeed, in my argument before the court, I'm going to be referring to these political philosophers as showing a context that is relevant to the court in understanding what's wrong with the Christian Horizons decision. So first, John Gray. His insights come in a book called Two Faces of Liberalism. And what John Gray points out in that is that since the beginning of liberal thought, there's been really two streams, and that it hasn't really been well realized how these two streams are radically inconsistent with each other, and how one of them is illiberal and attacks genuine liberalism, and the other one supports genuine liberalism. And here's what the two streams are. In the first, tolerance is recognized as a way station on the way to eventual agreement. That is to say, we accept tolerance for a while only because we're eventually going to move towards accepting what is, for the moment, contested beliefs. So I'll give you an example. In this reading of things, whether the issue is a controversial one like abortion or same-sex marriage or military spending, we would allow diversity of viewpoint for a while until we assume there will be eventual convergence of belief and acceptance of the new state, largely through law guiding and nudging politics and the law itself in the direction of agreement. And this is, you can see language like this in some of the Supreme Court decisions. A good example is in the Rodriguez case dealing with physician-assisted suicide some years ago, when the swing vote judgment of Justice John Sapinka opted, and this was a 5-4 decision against physician-assisted suicide. If Sapinka had gone the other way, we'd have had assisted suicide or euthanasia in Canada years ago. Justice Sapinka said that he was voting against physician-assisted suicide on the grounds that, in his words, the social consensus had not yet developed to support euthanasia. So for Justice Sapinka, using the term social consensus, it's clear that he's looking to this idea of eventual consensus. Okay, now, the second idea of liberalism, John Gray refers to as modus vivendi, that is to say, how we live together, the methods of living together. And the key distinction is, in this reading, tolerance isn't a temporary thing on the way to eventual agreement, but tolerance is a necessary continuing state because we will not eventually agree. And the law must not force us to eventual agreement, but must rather recognize the continuing capacity to disagree. And therefore, the law's role and the social role is to figure out the principles of cooperative disagreement. So in the first, Peter Lowers and I have referred to that in some of our writing as convergence liberalism. We're going to converge on agreement. And in the second, we like to think of that as managed coexistent disagreement. Very, very different. Now, here's the kicker. Gray says that the future of genuine liberalism requires that liberalism turn its face against convergence liberalism and endorses modus vivendi, or living together with disagreement, or figuring out the principles in which communities like Christian Horizons can continue to live within the wider Canadian society while endorsing forms of their own belief which don't accord with the beliefs of other communities. Remember, there are quite a few organizations providing the kind of care Christian Horizons provides, but people, citizens, are free to choose Christian Horizons' Christian ethos for their loved ones. Government money is used within Christian Horizons, but if Christians can function in the public sphere, as I suggested at the outset, it's a good thing that that kind of care be an option for citizens to choose. There are other kinds of care that they may choose. But within a John Gray one liberalism, convergence, you can see why the arguments are, well, Christian Horizons is discriminating against a certain kind of sexual orientation, and the law, therefore, should suppress that kind of project. And that's what's going on. In convergence liberalism, Christian Horizons needs to be expunged, needs to be diminished. And in fact, in the convergence liberalism approach, associations like religions need to eventually be airbrushed out because their religious perspectives don't accord with those of secular society. So when you start to pull the lens back on this point that John Gray is making, you realize he's onto something of exceeding importance with respect to associational rights. Because one of the criticisms in Canadian philosophy of law is that our rights theories have been premised on an individual understanding of rights that pay too little attention to associational commitments. Now, in this case, Connie Heintz is an individual. At one point, she agreed with the ethos of a particular association. She then changed her mind. Her change of mind as an individual weighs more on the scales of analysis than 2,000 plus employees joining a religious organization with a 40-year history and an unblemished track record of government service. Think of that in terms of the bleaching out of associational distinctions. One person's change of mind can eradicate the religious ethos effectively in the public sphere for a whole organization. That's quite a significant weighing on the scales, I think. And is it a just weighing on the scales? Is that really what we want in society? Do we want to see associational distinctions bleached out or airbrushed out? Gray cautions against what he calls an illiberal fundamentalism that hides all too easily in what looks like a liberal approach to tolerance and diversity, but is not. Quote, "It is a mark of an illiberal regime that conflicts of value are viewed as signs of error. Yet liberal regimes which claim that one set of liberties, their own, is universally legitimate, adopts precisely this view. They treat conflicts among liberties as symptoms of error, not dilemmas to which different solutions can be reasonable. Liberalism of this kind is a species of fundamentalism, not a remedy for it." Unquote. I think Gray's exactly correct here. And I think that this problem, if we think about it in the context of so many cases over the past two decades in Canada, whether it's Trinity Western, whether it's the Vreen decision here from this very facility, whether it's Brocky, the printer in downtown Toronto who refused to print certain materials and was ordered by human rights to print them against his conscience and belief. In all of these cases, individual objection, and this is a key point, on what is a legally contestable matter. We're not talking about racism here, which we've rejected as a society. We're talking about viewpoints in relation to things like the nature of marriage. It's not illegal to hold a heterosexually affirmative view of marriage as against a same-sex view of marriage. It's legal to hold both views, so I call those legally contestable. It's not illegal to hold the view that abortion is wrong. It's not illegal to hold the view that abortion is right. They're legally contestable. Keep in mind John Gray's theory here. What he says is that in an illiberal kind of liberalism, a false or pseudo-liberalism, the tendency will be to eradicate one kind of legally contestable viewpoint through the idea that we all need to agree. So, in that universe, people who affirm heterosexual marriage will eventually be squeezed out. Their viewpoint on marriage will become one that can't be argued for. It'll be stereotyped as discriminatory, and its projects will be eventually disabled, either through attacks on charitable status, which limit its ability to continue to function, or attacks on its representatives, who will be denied office and representative capacity on national bodies, and so on and so forth. This is the world in which physicians who don't want to perform abortions or pharmacists who don't want to be involved in distributing abortifacients lose their jobs or are suspended from their organizations. And it happens to be the world that we're seeing developing in Canada. It is an achievement to develop the social ability to accommodate dissent. Always has been. It's always been a struggle for a liberal society to find the means of accommodating dissent. And we are in that situation now where we have to struggle to find means of dissent. And Christian Horizons project was, in a sense, an ethos of providing a certain kind of care within a code of conduct that represented a particular view of the human person in relationship that does not accord with a rising, very powerful movement of sexual orientation recognition. But I think it's very important for the maintenance of the freedom of our society that these legally contestable, diverse communities continue to coexist. And the threat, as we see in Christian Horizons, is very much with us towards homogeneity, one viewpoint. The second contemporary scholar whose work is particularly helpful in this area is the former advisor to the Clinton administration in the U.S., a political philosopher, William Galston. Now, Galston approaches Gray's concerns from a slightly different angle and argues that autonomy and diversity are competing theoretical conceptions within liberalism. I mean, think of how apropos that is in this case. For Galston, autonomy and diversity, autonomy, Connie Heinz's viewpoint, and individual rights, versus diversity, the viewpoint of Christian Horizons and its employees, which also is a group made up of the autonomy of thousands of people who've chosen that particular associational expression. But anyway, autonomy and diversity are competing theoretical conceptions within liberalism. For Galston, here's what he says. The accommodation of diversity within a determinate but limited conception of liberal public purposes is a better foundation for liberal philosophy than is the promotion of rational reflection or personal autonomy, however attractive these values may be to important professions and social classes within liberal societies. He continues, he says, pluralist politics is a politics of recognition rather than construction. It respects the diverse spheres of human activity. It does not understand itself as creating or constituting those activities. Families are shaped by public law, but that does not mean they are socially constructed. So, according to Galston, the state must not throw its weight behind ideals of personal excellence outside the shared understanding of civil excellence, and it must not give pride of place to understandings of personal freedom outside the shared understanding of civic freedom. For if it does so, the liberal state will prescribe, as valid for and binding on all, a single debatable conception of how human beings should lead their lives. In the name of liberalism, says Galston, it will betray its own deepest and most defensible principles. Now, here's a point I want to make that I think is far too little understood in Canada, and it has to do with respect and disagreement. It is frequently said that if you do not accept the conduct choices of gays and lesbians, you are rejecting their dignity as persons. I think this is a false argument, because we can analogize to religious belief. Religious beliefs, like sexual conduct beliefs, are chosen, deeply meaningful to the person. Now, if we think about the rejection of religious belief, is it the case that I can respect you as a person and reject your religious belief? Can I say I think the views of Mormons or Baptists or Catholics are unacceptable and wrong, and still respect the Mormon or the Baptist or the Catholic? I think the answer is yes. We don't make a linkage between acceptance of religious propositions and the dignity of the person. Why do we accept the standard argument publicly made frequently by same-sex activists that the rejection of their viewpoints on sexual conduct is a rejection of their dignity as citizens? Now, this is an important point to make, and it's an important one that needs to be made culturally. I can respect the dignity of a gay or lesbian person while still rejecting their choice of sexual conduct as valid. In the same way, they can respect my religious beliefs while rejecting my religious beliefs as valid. I think this is the way we have to move the argument forward. We have to create a better set of spaces for disagreement. Part of modus vivendi is to learn to live together with disagreement, without making false claims about dignity, or without airbrushing out or eradicating associational distinctions. Oxford's philosopher Joseph Raz once put the matter this way, and I think it's a telling quotation, that's why I want to share it with you. A government dedicated to pluralism and autonomy cannot make people good. To be autonomous, they have to choose their own lives for themselves. Governments and other people generally can help people flourish, but only by creating the conditions for autonomous life, primarily by guaranteeing that an adequate range of diverse and valuable options shall be available to all. Beyond that, they must leave individuals free to make of their lives what they will. In other words, what we want from government is the conditions, the maintenance of conditions for diversity to continue to exist. We don't want the government to eradicate the possibility of diversity through the policies that groups like, or tribunals like human rights put into place. The real risk of the decision in Christian Horizons is that the instrument of the state, the instrumentarium of the state through human rights, is being used to affect one side of the legally contestable debate on sexual orientation and religious views of sexual conduct. That's what's happening. Connie Hines says, "I've decided I'm a lesbian," goes to human rights, and human rights says to the employer, "You can no longer maintain your viewpoint about conduct relating to sexuality or anything else that you tie to your religion." Secondly, you can't do that at all, and you can't do it because in part you're in the public sphere serving people who are not members of your religion. But the point that's missing in this is that citizens chose that provision of health care against other models that were on offer. So the state is effectively bleaching out the real diversity that exists, even though it was chosen by citizens, many of whom were not themselves religious. Okay, now I want to quickly touch on the point I referred to at the beginning, which is the comments made by Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin, which I want you to really think about what I'm going to read now, because it's so startling. In a lecture given in 2002 at a conference attended by Galston, the Clinton advisor, held at McGill University, Chief Justice McLaughlin, who had been invited to give a paper discussing conscience and religion, formulated the issue about conscience and religion this way. Listen carefully to what I'm about to read. Quote, "The modern religious citizen is caught between two all-encompassing sets of commitments. The law faces the seemingly paradoxical task of asserting its own ultimate authority while carving out a space within itself in which individuals and communities can manifest alternative and often competing sets of ultimate commitments." Note the terms all-encompassing and ultimate here in relation to the law, as well as the fact that it is the law that carves out within itself places for what may be the competing sets of ultimate commitments. Law is bigger than religion for her. The Chief Justice then develops the idea further as follows, quote, "I wish to call this tension between the rule of law and the claims of religion a dialectic of normative commitments. What is good, true, and just in religion will not always comport with the law's view of the matter, nor will society at large always properly respect conscientious adherence to alternate authorities and divergent normative or ethical commitments. Where this is so, two comprehensive worldviews collide. It is at this point that the question of law's treatment of religion becomes truly exigent. The authority of each is internally unassailable. What is more, both lay some claim to the whole of human experience. To which system should the subject adhere? How can the rule of law accommodate a worldview and ethos that asserts its own superior authority and unbounded scope? It is the courts that are most often faced with this clash and charged with managing this dialectic. Unquote. Law here is viewed frankly and openly as a comprehensive worldview, capable of competing with and even encompassing religion. Moreover, law is deemed capable of determining not only what is just, but what is good and true. It is able to lay claim, quote, to the whole of human experience, unquote. Now, whatever else one can say of this, it elevates law to the status of transcendent determinations, and therefore judges to the role of clerics. It is a considerable expansion of the role of law from what was understood since the passing of the days of theocracy, to be a largely terrestrial endeavor to one that seems to partake, frankly, of the divine and returns us to a theocratic condition, except this time, instead of the church ruling the law, it's the law ruling the church. With respect, the Chief Justice's formulation tends towards a monistic or totalistic conception and is quite contrary to that kind of political pluralism articulated by Galston, Gray, and Raz in the comments I quoted earlier, in which there are, in Galston's terms, visions of social space and spheres of autonomy that must resile from claims to be comprehensive goods. On this reading, the Chief Justice's conception of law asks too much when it views itself as larger than the religious and other conceptions alongside which it must operate. Now, in her response to the Chief Justice's paper, the fabulous University of Chicago philosopher Jean Bethke Elstein stated as follows: "Surely, where the rule of law in the West is concerned, there is a great deal about which the law is simply silent. The king's writ does not extend to every nook and cranny. Indeed, a great deal of self-governing autonomy and authority is not only permitted, but is necessary to a pluralistic constitutional order characterized by limited government. In other words, the law need not be defined as total and comprehensive in the way the Right Honorable Chief Justice claims." Unquote. Now, with respect, the way forward for constitutional adjudication in certain areas is to abandon the notion of the law's role in aid of forcing the approval of certain contested social conceptions, in just the way this was being done by certain contemporary judges or human rights decision makers such as Gottheil in Christian Horizons. That they do this idea of convergence and forcing agreement, shows an undeveloped or faulty conception of political pluralism and a zealous attempt, never expressed, to replace the primacy of religion in former days with an elevated role for law in our own. It appears then as if Gray was correct to speak of a kind of fundamentalism in the claim for comprehensiveness. His analysis, however, focused on the political aspects of what we might call convergence, but what I'm suggesting here is that there's clearly a legal kind of convergence as well. And the Chief Justice isn't alone in this. Former Justice Minister and a highly esteemed legal academic, Erwin Kotler, referred unblushingly to human rights as, quote, the new secular religion of our times, unquote. So where the Chief Justice is referring to law as containing comprehensive claims to meaning, like religion's comprehensive claims to meaning, and when the Justice Minister is speaking of law as the new secular religion of our times, something's deeply changing about the relationship between law and religion. And that is absolutely relevant to the development of these legal decisions in terms of how they treat religious communities. That's why we're seeing so many interesting and startling attacks on religion and religious communities at this time in our history in Canada. How do we respond to this? Well, Gray suggests we have to develop the principles of modus vivendi. how we live together with disagreement. I want to suggest that we've got some of these principles already in our thinking. But what we need to start doing is identifying them as aspects of modus vivendi, in a sense of pushback to this idea of one size fits all, that all citizens must agree on what are legally contestable matters. And the pushback, or the modus vivendi principles, I want to mention three. First, the principle of accommodation. We have it already in human rights. In other words, if somebody in your business has a religious belief that they don't want to work Saturdays, you as an employer have a duty to accommodate them up to the point of undue hardship. If a physician doesn't want to perform abortions in a hospital that performs abortions, the hospital must accommodate the physician. So this sense of accommodation is itself a recognition of diversity within a larger homogeneity. The second principle, subsidiarity. Subsidiarity isn't really well known as a term, although interestingly enough it appears in the European Charter. The Charter recognizes subsidiarity. It's a term frequently used within Roman Catholic social thought. Within certain Dutch Reform thought, it's known as sphere sovereignty. Basically, it's a recognition that there are, well, I'll read you really what the principle means in terms of positive and negative dimensions. Positively, the principle of subsidiarity means that all communities should encourage and enable, not merely permit, individuals to exercise their self-responsibility. And this is key, and I love this part, and most of us who read Schumacher's Small is Beautiful decades ago will resonate with it. Larger communities should do this for smaller communities. Put another way, decision-making responsibility in society should rest at the lowest level commensurate with the effective pursuit of the common good. To give a really practical example, the way we order our civic life should start with the smaller units. The larger units facilitate the smaller units' involvement. It doesn't usurp it. So, in France, where I currently live, planning for everything except heritage buildings is vested in the local mairie, at the local government level. It's decided by the villagers what their village will look like. Well, this is a very interesting thing, because when I was on Bowen Island and I chaired the residential land use committee there, many of the decisions we wanted to make about our island community were already made at the level of the ministry for the province of British Columbia. We have a road that goes right across Bowen Island in British Columbia that everyone joking refers to as the Coquihalla. It doesn't fit the community. It's way too big. It's ridiculously large. It was hugely expensive to put in. It's unpleasant. It aesthetically doesn't fit. It's way too big for what our needs are. But it was the size required by the Ministry of Highways on a provincial scale. So what's wrong with that is that the ministry's dropping the rules from the ministry level on the whole province, not sufficiently attending to what the citizens, knowing their needs, might have been able to develop in dialogue with the higher levels. In other words, they were trumped by the larger, not facilitated by it. The negative principle of subsidiarity means that communities must not deprive individuals, nor larger communities deprive smaller communities of the opportunity to do what they can for themselves. That's the point I just made about highway size. So subsidiarity, in other words, is a formal principle by which to regulate competencies between individuals and communities and between smaller and larger communities. Because it is a formal principle, its precise meaning and practice will differ according to circumstances, because it is rooted in the metaphysics of the person. It applies to the life of every society. Now, note here how the individual person is neither elevated nor subsumed in relation to the associational dimensions of a community, or beyond that, the state. Subsidiarity, therefore, provides a useful adjunct to the need to foster associational rights argued for elsewhere. So, the third principle, associational rights protection. It's very important that we recognize the importance of associations to individuals. It's been said in some of the recent literature that the right to religious freedom is an individual right. This has got to be wrong. Why? Because if I want to exercise my right to be religious, and its central characteristic is that it's individual, what do I join? I can only join something that pre-exists my individual choice as an association. There's only associations to join if those, in a sense, predate the individual. So the individual right to religious membership is dependent upon the existence of religious associations, not the other way around. The individual doesn't call into being the church. The individual joins the church that existed as an association prior to individual exercise of the will. This is very important, and our rights theory has tended to be too individualistic. Okay, so I think that's what I wanted to say, both about the context of these problems of airbrushing out associations and the problem of the convergent state forcing everybody to agree in light of the Christian Horizons case. And I'd be very grateful for any questions or of clarification or points of concern in relation to what I've been saying, or indeed to questions you might have. And I think we've got some time for that now, right? Okay. Yeah?
I'm pretty much in complete agreement, but it seems to me that the terms in which you address the Hines case are that the decision of the Human Rights Tribunal is wrong on grounds of, in the first case, associational rights, and in the second case, in other freedom of association, so on and so forth. And on the second one, freedom of speech, freedom to dissent. Could the court simply reply, this is not a question of associational rights, it's not a question of dissent, it's a question of employment, right? So we're not questioning the status of or the right of Christian Horizons as an association to define its values and so on and so forth. We're questioning its right to fire people on it, you know, fire employees. Right? It's not as an association, but as an employer. And we're not questioning their right to dissent on any of this stuff, and even to publish works under the name, right, saying why we think such and such is wrong. What we're questioning is the right of people other than firing people. So is addressing it at the level of questions of dissent, freedom of speech, or questions of associational rights the appropriate place to go, and if that's where you want to direct it, those courts have an easy answer to that.
Yeah. The questioner is asking whether the points made in the paper relative to associational rights or dissent really really get at the statutory interpretation questions. And the answer is no. There are a whole series of legal statutory interpretation points that we're making in argument, such as primarily engaged in the services of, if you look at section 24.1, doesn't mean only engaged in serving your own people, so that the tribunal misread the statute. There's also some history that I'm putting in my factum about how the legislation changed over time. It used to say religious organizations that exclusively served their own interests were protected, and then it was changed to primarily engaged in. And the reason for the shift from exclusively to primarily engaged in was to broaden it, to make it more easy. And in fact, what the tribunal decision does is revert to the old language of exclusively, which is a statutory interpretation error that the court could well seize on to overturn the decision by itself and avoid all of the charter values type analysis. And were I a judge actually engaged in law rather than in juristic politics, I might want a legal way out of this case that's neat and makes sense in terms of the law, and that is that the statute was misconstrued in a way that was unreasonable in view of the fact that the statute needs to be read as remedial legislation in what's called a liberal and purposive manner. It's a legal phrase meaning it has to be read broadly to affect its objects, not narrowly. And what we would say is that the Human Rights Tribunal here read the statute very narrowly. So there are legal arguments that we're making. I'm giving you the broadest brush for the sake of, you know, an interesting paper, I hope. in terms of where the law is going off course. Yeah.
Did it matter in that case where
Yeah, that's a very good question. The question is asking two things, really. One, if the provision of monies for a project is from the general public revenues, from taxes generally provided by citizens, can it have an exclusive religious rationale for its operation? And secondly, what would happen to the analysis in this case if the only provider in the sector was that religious employer, and therefore nobody, particularly those in a minority position, could get employment in that sector? Well, two things here. First, the fact of public funding is not determinative of the freedom of citizens to have divergent projects. That's the first thing. In fact, that if we read the provision of funding as requiring affirmation of one side of legally contested viewpoints, we're effectively allowing the state to dictate which legally contested viewpoints are going to be publicly successful. So our whole approach that public funding means non-religious articulation, and that's a commonly put proposition, that you can't have a publicly funded religious project because of the separation of church and state, is how it's often put, which is an American doctrine. The Canadian doctrine is really the cooperation of church and state. And therefore, the question then is, on what basis, how do you decide what's reasonable cooperation and unreasonable cooperation? I think public funding is neither here nor there. But your second point, what if the whole sector is dominated by religious employment? I think the answer then is, well, then you may have a valid ground to say, to limit funding, but not to eradicate funding. So in other words, you may have a basis there to provide other forms of care in terms of long-term care for the developmentally challenged, but you don't have the right publicly, therefore, to eradicate the religious project. You raise this a possible example of this, the marriage commissioner question. Well, what would happen if all the marriage commissioners exercised their right not to perform same-sex marriages? To which the answer is, well, then the state would need to hire people who didn't have that objection, not force those who do have the objection to act in spite of it. Similarly, what would happen if, due to some sort of mass set of very powerful arguments, all physicians stopped doing abortions? What would happen? Would the state, A, have to start forcing physicians to do abortions, or B, find physicians who would do abortions? I think only B is consistent with a free and democratic society, for the state to come in and force people where matters are legally contestable. Remember, that's the bottom line. We're not talking about racism, where the state can force people in public places not to have that viewpoint. You can have the viewpoint, but you can't have the job. That's not the case with abortion. It's not the case with sexual conduct disagreement, which are legally contestable. So with respect to marriage commissioners, if the majority didn't want to perform same-sex marriage, the state has to find other people to do it. It can't force those who are doing it to do something they don't believe in. Same with abortions. That's the way the arguments, I think, have to go. Yeah.
I'm not sure about the clarify.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, isn't sexual orientation more like race insofar as it's immutable? It's not something we choose, it's something we're born with. I mean, the same thing is often said of religion. People really don't have a choice if they're born into a Hutterite community or various forms of religious community, Jewish, Hasidic family. They really don't have a choice. They're sort of, that's how their situation is. But it's not sexual orientation that we're talking about here. It's the actions consequent upon it which are legally contestable. In other words, you may be born with a particular sexual orientation or come to the conclusion that that's how you are. What's disagreed with by different religious traditions isn't the orientation, it's the conduct in relation to the orientation. Now, some people would say, well, you're saying that homosexuals have only the choice to be celibate, and whereas heterosexuals can marry. And I think that's true. That is a distinction between the religious viewpoint and the non-religious viewpoint. But I think it's one that society at the moment tolerates. It's not going to make the religious position illegal. There are some who might want it to be illegal, but at the moment it isn't, and therefore it is legally contestable. And you're right, race for a time, I mean, think of the anti-miscegenation laws in the United States where blacks couldn't marry whites. Eventually those were seen on a principled basis to be wrong, and now they would be unconstitutional. Bob Jones University in the States, famous case, was denied charitable status because of its rules related to interracial dating. I think there's a distinction between the Bob Jones interracial dating ban and the Christian Horizons sexual orientation conduct ban, because I think interracial matters are no longer acceptable in public policy, whereas heterosexual, homosexual conduct disputes are validly, you know, I'll say it again, legally contestable matters culturally. Now, things may develop in a way where that changes, but at the moment, it seems to me that we do allow these things to be legally contestable. Yeah. Choose amongst yourselves, which is...
I'm interested in this, or the last couple of comments, actually, when you talk in terms of things may change. If we take a historical view, 50 years ago, 1949, sexual orientation, homosexuality was illegal.
We didn't used to view women as being capable of voting. You know, I mean, there's lots of examples of conceptions related to gender or capacity, legality, illegality that have shifted. My thought here is that it's true that you can have development within a tradition, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be accepting the claims that are made in the way of the development. In other words, I do not think that we are going to see the majority of Christian churches accept the validity of same-sex conduct. In the long run, I don't think they will do that, because many of them have a deeply seated ontological argument. And you may say, well, that was the way it was with racial stuff as well. I mean, and I think it's probably true. There were theological justifications for racial distinctions in South Africa. There still are. I often run into them. I don't know the answer to that, except to say that a society, I guess, can determine at a point in time that certain viewpoints are no longer legally contestable, like racism. But we're not there with respect to sexual conduct. I mean, think of it, we're not there even with respect to heterosexual sexual conduct, apropos polygamy challenges. So it's not really, it's not just sexual orientation with respect to gays and lesbians that's in the air at the moment. We're having to determine whether the extension of the marital category beyond two people is valid. The people in Bountiful in British Columbia want to argue that the dyadic restriction to two people is wrong. From their point of view, it's unnecessary and wrong. And the big debate, and the interesting one legally, and it's very much in the air in British Columbia, the Attorney General was just talking with their lawyers the other day about this, they're going to have to decide whether to take to law for determination whether Canada will or will not, whether BC will or will not accept polygamy. I don't know the answer to that. And they don't know the answer to it. And when I was counsel for the Interfaith Coalition on Same-Sex Marriage a few years ago, because I argued it in two provinces, one of the things I said to the court is, look, if you abolish gender, the male-female distinction in marriage, how on earth are you going to preserve number? One man, one woman. There's no real logical basis why if you abandon gender, you're going to keep number. And they didn't want to deal with that. Well, they're going to have to deal with it now, because the logic of these things does flow. But even if we, in British Columbia, we do adopt polygamy as valid, there are going to be those who think it's bad and want to argue it's bad. There are going to be those who think it's good and want to argue it's good. And I think when that happens, we've got to figure out a way in our terms of our diversity to allow both to stay in play. So I don't know if I'm answering your point, but it seems to me it's not just with respect to sexual orientation that we have this problem. We have it with respect to all kinds of areas.
What I have heard you say, though, is that the Christian faith community, by and large, is unlikely to change with respect to its views on sexual orientation.
Some of it, yeah. Some of it. Some of it already has changed. I mean, clearly we know...
Some of it has.
Yeah, in part because I fear the development of a homogeneous and unitive state. The idea that the state will tell us what to think on everything, I think, is, along with George Grant, an appalling tyranny. And what are the checks on this homogeneous and unitive state? Well, I think it's associational freedom. So I'm really of the view, and this is probably a civil libertarian conception as well, that we want to maximize the ability of the citizenry to have its freedom to dissent, to express. See, one of the interesting principles in law for the freedom of expression is that it protects the search for truth, expression itself. Well, built into that is the idea that our debates about what is right and wrong culturally matter as a society because they help us towards defining what's the best and what's the truest. If the state starts telling us to shut up, it shuts down the debate about truth and goodness. And it was Kennedy who said, I think quite perceptively, that if you make peaceful revolution impossible, you make violent revolution inevitable. So shutting down the capacity for dissent ultimately cuts off the branch you're sitting on as a civil society. So I want there to be United Church of Canada views on same-sex, Catholic views on same-sex conduct, Metropolitan Community Church views on same-sex conduct. They're radically different from each other, but they, I think, create the kind of civil discourse that teaches us how, what's true, what's better, what's worse, how we live together with disagreement. That seems to be the mark of a mature society and a civil society. And I fear the shutting down of debate. And I think over and over again, the claims from activists are not just we've got access now, but shut the others up. And I think it's the shut the others up, close the other institutions down, they're discriminators. Very dangerous. And that's what comes in the wake of achievement often is, the, in a sense, the pendulum swings too far out. And that's the point at which civil libertarians have to stand up and say, time out, this has gone too far. And Christian Horizons is an associational time out case. I think in Christian Horizons we're saying, okay, sexual orientation's made these massive achievements culturally in terms of recognition. But when one individual can shut down a whole association's conception of how it wants to live and what other citizens can choose, it's gone too far. It's the tail wagging the dog. And I really think that's what's going on here. Whether we'll be successful in the courts remains to be seen. Yeah.
I was interested in your quote from the law about the same religion. And so you reference down to,
yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, the point is made is that the courts have always had a necessary but limited role of supervision over administrative tribunals, and isn't that the same over religions? I think that's, in a way, that's right, that religions are free except that they can't breach public order, morals, safety, you know. So child sacrifice, female circumcision, so on, for a religious rationale would be equally unacceptable. But beyond that, the court isn't going to superintend the non-public order moral questions of religion. And that raises, I think that's right. My point about Chief Justice McLaughlin's speech was the way in which she viewed all of religion as encompassed by law. Because I think that's wrong. I think the law has that limited means of public order, safety, morals, limited window into religions. But the idea that law encompasses all of religion within itself, I think, is a massive expansion of the role of law. And here's an interesting example. One of the things I tried to get my clients in the same-sex marriage case to think about, unsuccessfully, was the question as to whether the state should be involved in marriage at all. A group of us had started to talk in terms of the role of the state in relation to marriage being a recent development. Prior to the 19th century, certainly the 18th century, marriage was done by associations, not by the state. To this day, all the marital records in Quebec are kept by the church. The reason why when you go to weddings, there's the signing of the civic documents is because of that blend, that marriage, in a sense, of the state and religions in this question of marriage, which is so foundational to the society. But when you no longer had a social agreement about the nature of marriage, I think the question ought to have been raised, and never was in Canada because we had such quick recourse to litigation. The question ought to have been raised, well, let's go back to first principles and discuss, now that we no longer agree about the nature of marriage, whether the state really should have any role in it at all. And the answer would have, I think, been something like, well, the state is concerned about children. The state is concerned about division of assets consequent upon dissolution of the arrangement. The question is, what is the arrangement that the state's interested in? And I think we could have had a registration model akin to the Scandinavian countries for what they called registered domestic partnerships, or what Hawaii called reciprocal beneficiaries. In other words, you could have a kind of recognition that human beings get into relationships that they're going to register through the state, but it's desexualized at that point. And what did the whole rationale for allowing homosexuality to be legalized was Trudeau's famous dictum that the state has no place in the bedrooms of the nation. Well, if that's true, why is the state still interested in conjugality? Why is it interested in sex? Really, what the state should have been interested in was registration, the effect on children, not on what constitutes the union. So any two persons should have been able to register at City Hall, whether or not they were sexually involved with each other. That's the logic of this approach, and it would have defused this whole public claim for sexual recognition, which is what's driving the steam behind the sexual orientation movement. See, they wanted the state to stay in marriage. When I made this argument, started to make it in some of the stuff I was writing, it got furious response from same-sex activists. Why? Because what they wanted was public recognition. They didn't just want their association to recognize their marriages. They wanted the whole of society to recognize their marriages. Well, that's the one thing that certain religions don't want to do. They'll give respect, but they don't want to call them marriages. Well, if we'd taken marriage out of the state, we could have avoided all this. But the fact of the matter is, we're all statists now. We all want the state to do everything. So what was being played in the courts was a huge game of what the kids call King of the Castle, where you had the traditional religions trying to push the same-sex activists off the hill and the same-sex activists pushing religion off, trying to get the definition of marriage. And I told the religious clients, you're going to lose this one. Isn't it better to reconsider the role of the state in relation to marriages? Allow the Metropolitan Community Church to do gay marriages for itself, and you're allowed to do your marriages, and public school curriculum is unaffected. If you have same-sex marriage as a constitutional norm, public school curriculum is going to have to change to accommodate the norm, thereby alienating your conception of marriage from public school curriculum, which is exactly what's happening now. The whole debate is now shifted to the public recognition norms. And religious communities are now becoming increasingly alienated from public education. We didn't need to go down that road. But, of course, in Canada, we're so addicted to litigation as a means of social ordering. You know, Charles Taylor, in one of his books, says litigation is not the way to form social policy because it's insufficiently able to have consensus. You have a winner and a loser when you come out of a courtroom on a constitutional case. And a lot of this stuff isn't about winning and losing. It's about modus vivendi, how we live together. The court is not going to develop the principles of cooperative living. That can only be done through proper legislative approaches. But as I say, we're addicted to litigation. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's... No, I think you're raising an interesting point, but the difference with the doctor, if the doctor was working for every woman's health clinic, okay, which does abortions, you know, abortions are us, that's what it does. If the doctor was working for them and then said, I don't want to do abortions, that's the analogy to Heinz and Christian Horizons. Because Heinz and Christian Horizons is a subset with an ethos. The reason why the doctor in public health doesn't work is because the public health system is the state, and of course there has to be a right of dissent against the state. I wouldn't grant the physician the right of dissent within every woman's health center, because every woman's health center exists to do abortions. As far as I'm concerned, any physician who's pro-life, who's stupid enough to work for every woman's health center, has no right of dissent once they take the position. Because the conditions of entry, it's actually a very helpful point you've just given me here. The conditions of entry to the group restrict the capacity for dissent. But you don't have that argument when it's the state, because there is no place to go. Okay. Now, Connie Heinz has every right to assert her sexual orientation in a non-ethos-specific framework, and that's your point. Well, what if there was no other provider of long-term care? Well, then I think you do have an interesting point that this my principled approach would have to bend towards, because my principled approach depends on a right of exit, right of alternative access. But, quick segue here to something that's in the air, and this hasn't been thought of, and I think it's a very elegant way out of the problem. Right now, the pharmacists in Canada are fighting for the recognition to dissent from distributing controversial pharmaceuticals like RU486, the abortive acient. They don't want to do it. And the argument that's being used against them by their professional association is, well, you know what, this could be a small community in which you're the only pharmacist. We can't acknowledge your right to dissent because you could be in a small community. Well, here's the answer, and I don't think anyone's thought of this. Lawyers' associations provide what's called a lawyer's referral service. It's a number provided by the Bar Association of the different provinces for citizens to access legal services under a set of categories they want. Why don't the pharmacists have a pharmaceutical referral number that citizens can call if they want something they can't get from the local pharmacist? This is precisely the point at which the Pharmacists Association might have a duty to provide access. But the access provision shouldn't be on the shoulders of the individual pharmacist with a right to dissent. If every citizen has a right to dissent, then the associations have a duty to provide an effective right of dissent. So if you flick it around a bit, this places the onus where it should be, on the associational rulemaking. It's a very interesting way out of this, and I've never seen it argued for by associations. But I think it's the way the pharmacists need to start arguing this, is that in rural communities, if you're a pharmacist who isn't going to do the abortion morning after pill, you put that right up, you put the sign on your counter, I do not prescribe that because it goes against my beliefs. Here's the general number to call the pharmacist if you think that's what you need. And the duty's now on the pharmacy association where it should be. And that's a good example of a practical application of modus vivendi to a dilemma. You're all wonderful staying awake here. One more question, I think, and then we should probably end it. Yeah, I think I'm a strong advocate for the right to dissent for marriage commissioners. And not only that, I mean, if I'm a gay marriage commissioner and I think heterosexual marriage furthers patriarchy and is nasty, I don't think I should have to marry heterosexuals. I only do gay marriages. Fine. No problem with that. I think that's, the civil society has to find means of accommodating these viewpoints. This idea that marriage commissioners, because they're funded by the state, have to perform X, Y, or Z. No, doesn't work for me at all. Don't think that follows.
To your case there, I've heard controversy about, you know, Dr. Salem, you know, an abortion. The doctor has a right to refuse, but there are people who want to say that, that the doctor then has a duty to refer you.
Yeah.
Isn't that case analogous? Because a lot of pro-life doctors say, look, you know, that's not letting me off the moral hook. That's not really sent if I have to refer you.
Right. There can be no duty of referral. No, it's just bad philosophy. There can be no duty of referral. If you recognize the duty of dissent, there can be no duty of referral. And the CMA understands that. The pharmacists don't want to understand that. They want to keep a duty of referral in there. And in fact, I had lunch yesterday with the, amongst others, the head of the College of Physicians for Alberta. And I basically just said that to him. Your principle of duty of referral is not, ultimately, I don't think it's legally sustainable, because it places the person with the objection in the chain of causation to the very thing they object to. So morally, it's just bankrupt.
What I'm wondering is, if your most of any solution to the pharmacist dilemma is, in effect, just have to ask them to do that, put up signs that
You do it for doctors as well as pharmacists. It's not referral. No, because you don't do it like that. You'd say, whole association would say, if you seek a service that your physician does not provide, call this number.
Done by the association.
It's done by the association. It's elegant. It works. It's not morally, no one's going to object to that. It's an excellent social solution to that problem. But here's the rub. Those who want physicians and pharmacists to be the instrument of their practice do not want this kind of elegant solution. They want to force convergence. And that's, you're going to run into people who want physicians to be forced to do abortions. That's why, and they're the ones who want to ask at the entry level of medical school entrance, and this is happening in the States, they want questions asked of students applying to medical school. If you get accepted to medical school and you become a doctor, will you perform abortions? That's a question being allowed in some medical school entrance interviews to screen out pro-life potential physicians. I think that's iniquitous, but that's what's happening. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ian. Yeah.